The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome to the program today Jeffrey Burton. He joins us on telephone in Minnesota. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks, Vic. It's an honor to be here.
You have a new book out. It's called The Keepers, and this is the first book of yours that I have read, and it looks like this is the second book in a series. Is that right?
It is.
Okay. Tell us about this series.
Yeah, well, the series is it's about a dog handler, Mason Reed. He goes by Mace, and he lives in the outskirts of Chicago. And the first book in the series that came out a year ago and is in paperback now is called The Finders. And that's because that's what he calls his pack of human remains detection dogs, HRD dogs, kind of also known as cadaver dogs. And The Finders, I think the elevator pitch is Mace and his human remains detection dogs versus a serial killer and The Finders. And then in the book you read, The Keepers, it's Mace and the pack of cadaver dogs versus some corruption at the highest level in Chicago.
Well, you picked the right city.
Yeah. Certainly an interesting past.
Well, I used to go to Chicago when I was a kid, and it was the only place I can recall where when I'd see a police officer, I wouldn't feel safe. I would feel kind of frightened. There was something about the random police officers that I would see. Maybe it's because they had to be so tough in that town, but they really were kind of scary people, some of them.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I had the same feeling. My dad, for some reason, took me to Vegas when I was 15. And he said, you know, oh, don't hang around me. I'm going to be over here. Don't hang around me. And so I'm at some slot machine, and then this shadow just falls over me. And I turn around, and it's the biggest cop I've ever seen, and his arms are crossed, and he's staring at me. And I got to appreciate how nothing was said. I just walked out of the casino.
Like you weren't supposed to be there?
No, I don't think at age 15. They may have frowned on that.
I see. But I was trying to figure out what you were doing wrong.
Yeah, they saved me from losing.
Okay. Well, in this one, we do have corruption at the highest levels. And we also have a city which is currently and has been for a long time plagued by gun violence. This is part of the story. Set the scene here. Tell us what we've got going on in this one.
Well, Mace has a real special cadaver dog, kind of the Sherlock Holmes of cadaver dogs, and a special prosecutor is found dead. They're called in to search Washington Park in Chicago, and they find the poor guy has been murdered. They find the body, and then something happens when some of the authorities show up that kind of clues Mace in that this may be not a random killing, and it may be coming from kind of the highest level of the Chicago Police Department.
Yeah, and currently in Chicago, we've got a mayor who's been under fire because of things that the police have been doing, and there's a lot of conflict between this mayor and the police. By a weird coincidence, I actually know the mayor of Chicago.
You do?
I actually went to a Chicago White Sox game with her before she was the mayor. I know her through a mutual friend. I wouldn't say that we're friends or even acquaintances, but I have spent, you know, a baseball game with her once upon a time. And I know that she's plagued by controversy, and there's always a scandal in Chicago and in the state of Illinois. This is a state where so many of the governors have ended up going to prison.
Right. I kind of get into that a little bit in the book, and they've sadly, you know, the murder rate, a lot of, you know, drive-bys and gangs. My wife and I would go to Chicago, you know, cheap airfare, and we'd go there and just kind of have fun, go and see some plays and catch a ball game. And she used to have trade shows, so I would kind of go with her, and I'd get the free hotel, and she'd have to go to work, and I could kind of goof around in the different areas of Chicago. But yeah, I mean, it is really sad, the number of you know, murders that are happening there.
Well, you have a mayor in this one. Obviously, it's not the current mayor; it's a fictional mayor, and he kind of makes a cameo appearance. And I'm not going to say much more about him, but the mayor has oversight over the police. So if there's stuff going on with the police, the mayor should know about it. The mayor has this duty to keep track of what the police are up to. And yet we have such a huge department. You have some statistic in your book about how many Chicago police officers have been sent to jail for crimes. I mean,
yeah,
it's just unbelievable.
Yeah. It's incredible. And, you know, I had written, as crazy as stuff is, I had written a standalone novel, but my agent in St. Martin's Press wanted a series. And so, believe it or not, they wanted me to break the book in half. And so The Keepers, the bulk of The Keepers was really the book that I wrote first. And The Finders, I wound up, you know, having to write a good chunk kind of... So they're kind of the keepers. The majority of it I wrote first, and for that part you're talking about, I had to go in and kind of update some of the numbers because it was from 2-3 years ago. And then I think sadly this year they're, you know, might even break the homicide rate.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating to know what the story is behind these books, the way that. One book turned into two. That's really odd. Does that mean that you're done, or are you going to keep writing about this?
Yeah, you know, I mean, originally when I had written the first book, The Finders, you know, it was more my agent and St. Martin's Press had said, no, we want a series. And so I've got a 3-book deal. I'm hoping it'll turn into more, so the next book will come out next summer.
Okay. Well, this guy, Mace, he has this house full of dogs. Do you want to tell us about each dog that he's got?
Yeah, I sure will. I mean, it's, you know, I just tripped over the idea of having cadaver dogs because, you know, you've had a lot of dogs that are finding explosives or illicit narcotics. And I thought, well, you know, I mean, with a cadaver dog, you've kind of got a built-in mystery if you find a body. And so Mace has his pack of finders includes Vira, whose name is actually Elvira. He names them after kind of country rock songs.
Mm-hmm.
I'll save your listeners from listening to me sing.
No, go ahead.
Oh, no. It's I'm sadly, I love music, but can't really carry a tune.
Okay.
But oom-pop-a-loom-pop-a-loom-pop-a-mow-mow.
Good. All right.
Yeah. I don't know if I can go as low as that one guy for the Oak Ridge Boys.
All right.
So Vira is kind of the main dog, the dog that is kind of the Sherlock Holmes of cadaver dogs. And then he's got a German Shepherd named Sue from the Johnny Cash song.
Uh-huh.
And he's got a couple of sister collies, Delta Dawn and Maggie May. And in The Keepers, he gets a new dog, Billy Joe, from Ode to Billy Joe.
Uh-huh. Bobby Gentry.
Yeah. Patchy Bridge. Bill's a bloodhound, and he his thing is a lot of times dogs from just instinctual from trying to hide their scent when they were, you know, after something, they'd roll in something to disguise their scent, but... Bill the Bloodhound is kind of making Mace's life a little miserable because he's taken great joy in rolling around in anything that's any pile of stink he can find.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I was, I was making a list the other day, Vic, is good sniffer dogs, you know, they have like a bloodhound has 300 million scent receptors in their nasal cavity. And you and I, we only have 5 million. And I was kind of, you know, just for the heck of it, I was kind of making a list of, well, what do I smell as a human? And I'm like, well, yeah, popcorn. You know, if the neighbors are burning leaves, you know, maybe some ozone smell before a storm or some barbecue, or if something in the garbage has gone bad. But it was hard for me to kind of get into the double digits, because I think we've kind of evolved our eyesight, and maybe our hands have kind of taken dominancy.
Huh.
But dogs are able, I mean, the sniffer dogs, which, you know, I mean, I've got a good mix, but also German Shepherds and Pit Bulls and Doberman Pinschers and, you know, Collies and Labradors are really good at you know, sniffing things out. And so anyways, I thought that would be a interesting way to introduce mysteries.
Uh-huh. And appropriately, Sue, named after the Johnny Cash song, is a male dog. And
right.
And the other one, Maggie May, is that the Rod Stewart song?
It is.
Okay,
Maggie
so
May,
you, that's not a country song.
No.
Oh, okay, all right.
He switches it up
okay,
a little bit.
I just checking on that.
Right.
Okay.
And Delta Dawn, I think, was Helen Reddy and Tanya Tucker.
Tanya Tucker, I know. Uh-huh.
I think that's the main one, isn't it? The Tanya Tucker.
Yeah, song. I would call that country.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO, and The Book Nook will continue right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO with my guest Jeffrey Burton. We're talking about his new crime novel. It's The Keepers.
Vira is able to kind of take it to the next degree because she'll kind of smell things. And I kind of tie it into how, you know, we have forensics where you've got, you know, DNA and maybe mm-hmm. some blood or blood splatter or fingerprints. Well, Vira is able to kind of take in, and she kind of tries to make connections that may help trip over the killer. And she, Vira had an interesting backstory, you know, with in the first book, Vic, when she was a puppy, she had some trauma and kind of a near-death experience. And Mace wound up being able to kind of rescue her from Chicago Animal Care and Control. Train her as being a cadaver dog.
Uh-huh. And Vira's a golden retriever, right?
Vira's a golden retriever. Okay. That is the one thing that I'll get feedback from folks that are like, well, you know, I've raised golden retrievers and they're so gentle and loving and not aggressive. And Vira is, you know, she's gentle and loving but she can get aggressive if the pack is threatened. And Mace is thinking, well, that probably goes back to the trauma at an early age, or it's just her intelligence. And I had, when I was writing the book, I had a bit of a struggle because I didn't want Mace to be with the, you know, kind of like the Terminators, you know, the dogs like the German Shepherds or uh-huh. Doberman Pinscher, Pit Bull Terriers. You know, because, you know, you wanted it more people, they have a reputation and it's, you know, it's a bit sad with the pit bulls because they're great dogs.
Uh-huh.
I mean, my neighbor has a pit bulls. It's only because their strength and they're great athletes that you get like the, was that football guy, Michael Vick and folks that train them to be nasty and to fight.
Yeah.
But because of the reputation, I didn't want him to have, you know, a Doberman Pinscher, a German Shepherd, or a Pit Bull.
Right. So I understand.
Right.
You wanted kinder, gentler reputation dogs.
Right.
Right. And Vira, she is so good at identifying when there's an issue. And this is kind of dangerous because people notice that she's reacting to something. And if the wrong person notices, early in the book, you have a guy who's one of your villains. And I really like this villain. He starts off being kind of one-dimensional. You call him the Man Mountain, and he's a chauffeur.
Right.
And you just think of him as just this massive, unstoppable thug, a homicidal guy. And yet by the end of the book, we start to kind of like him because he's forced to take along this other villain with him who makes him look like almost a nice guy.
Yeah, he makes him look like a choir boy. Yeah, I kind of like Man Mountain. What happens, and this is not really a spoiler, is, I mean, Vira has kind of triggered on the scent of Man Mountain because he shows up at the crime scene and she goes ballistic with barking. And so all of a sudden, Mace is suddenly on this killer's radar.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I mean, Man Mountain is kind of, you know, I suppose I can kill this person or work on a crossword puzzle.
Right, right. He has an intellect, we discover.
Right, right.
He likes to analyze sayings.
He loves idioms.
Uh-huh, right.
And has fun learning about their history and stuff like that. And
yeah, it's a real shame you killed him off. I'm just kidding. You got to do that, though, right? You got to decide, okay, I'm going to have to kill this character, good or bad. You have to make that decision. How do you decide?
You know, I mean, I wanted to have a just knockdown, drag-out fight at the end that would he had done some really – by the end, he'd done some really bad stuff. So there was oh, man, I don't
– Don't spoil it. Don't spoil it.
I don't want to spoil it.
Okay, all right. We know he did bad stuff. We presume that.
He did some bad stuff.
Okay, yeah,
that's
good.
And he may or may not get his comeuppance.
Oh, okay, all right. So I'm the one who spoiled it.
No, that's okay.
Well, the other bad guy, I'm not going to say what happened to him. You're probably going to keep some of these bad guys around, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that they're all kind of different and standalone. Like in The Finders, it's completely different. And then in the next book, it's kind of completely different set of villains.
Okay. And the next book, have you already written it?
I have. You know, there's the child's rhyme, you know, finders, keepers, losers, weepers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the working title had been The Losers, but the editors at St. Martin's Press are like, you know, that's kind of a big thumb of a title. And I know I'll bounce ideas off my dad, and he had, you know, a year ago he had said the same thing. He's like, boy, you know, The Finders is a great title, The Keepers. Even The Weepers would be kind of an interesting title, but The Losers is kind of a, you know, not the greatest. And so we're kind of varying off, and the next book is going to be called The Lost.
Oh.
And it's about a 5-year-old girl who's been kidnapped, and Mace and Vira and the Finders, and he's able to work with this female officer, Kippy Gim, are on the trail, but then time is running out, and nothing is as it appears to be.
Okay.
So hopefully I'll have some twists and turns in that one.
All right. Well, I imagine since you've already finished writing it, you know you have twists and turns in it.
I do. Did I get you in a couple of twists and turns in The Keepers?
I think so. I think the scene in the mayor's office was the one that just really gave me I just about fell out of my chair. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, making radio with the community and for the community. My guest is Jeffrey B. Burton, and we're talking about The Keepers, the second book in his series, which features Mace Reed and his dogs that have really good noses. And I see that you've written other books aside from these. These aren't your first books. Tell us about you. Tell us about how you became a writer, your writing career so far, and some of these other books that you've written, which I have not yet read.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think I may be the only author that has the same. I wrote three mystery thrillers about an FBI agent, and each book was published by a different publisher. And how that happened was I had written The Chessmen about 10 years ago, and I connected. I didn't have an agent at the time, and I connected with McAdam Cage Publishing, which had had The Time Traveler's Wife and a few other bestsellers, kind of a smaller publisher in California. And so I connected with them, and the book came out to some great reviews, and it wound up being bought in Random House in Germany and in the Netherlands and in Turkey, of all places. However, you know, I'm kind of floating around in Minnesota doing my own thing. McAdam Cage was kind of circling the financial drain.
Mm.
And they wound up being sued about a week after my book came out. They wound up being sued by Penguin. I think it was before Penguin and Random House merged. And over some e-rights on a previous book. And so they ceased everything. And then the craziest thing, Vic, is the president of McAdam Cage then got lung cancer and a couple months later passed away. And so it was certainly an interesting experience within, you know, like 7 or 8 months of my book coming out, all of this drama to have occurred. I wound up getting emails from some remaining staff at McAdam Cage telling me not to worry, and I kept getting these emails right on up until they declared bankruptcy. And so instead of royalties, I wound up being in kind of this weird bankruptcy proceeding that I think Publishers Weekly has written a few articles on. And so the next book, The Lynchpin, I had passed on to them.
Oh, no.
And they had had a sister company on the Isle of Man that had an office in San Francisco. And so I'm here in Minnesota, you know, and all of a sudden I'm getting calls from San Francisco where they want to buy The Lynchpin, the second book. And, you know, I'm like, okay. So, you know, I signed with them, and a few months later, their entire San Francisco branch kind of quit in protest. And so I kind of struggled along with a couple of clerks on the Isle of Man where they're located. And then the book came out, and it was really, at this point, the clerks had quit, and it was really just kind of a horrible experience. So then I had already, at that time, I'd written The Eulogist, and I was able to connect with the Permanent Press, which is in New York, and they do a lot of mysteries and some literary stuff. So I was able to connect with them. And they published The Eulogist in, 3-4 years ago. And so at that point, I thought, you know something, I'm gonna start a new series, and I'm going to get me an agent.
Mm.
And it worked.
And that is this series, then?
That is this series.
Okay.
One of the things that I started before I started writing novels is I wrote a ton of short stories. And you know, so I think that's where I kind of learned my craft. And in my first book, The Chessmen, I almost, like with short stories, I try to do the O. Henry thing where you get done reading it and the last couple sentences almost changes everything.
Uh-huh.
So in The Chessmen, which got some really great reviews, it was almost like having, about 60 or 65 short stories that I cobbled together to just kind of keep the person turning pages. And I even, ironically, one of my short stories last year was in an anthology that the anthology won the Shirley Jackson Award.
Oh, so you were writing horror?
I was writing for this one. Yeah, I think it was a little horror. This one was definitely horror, but it was also, coincidentally, it was about a dog. I think the tagline was, it was called Liza, a little lost dog or a lost man, take your pick. And yeah, you're right. It was up for, the anthology was also up for the Stoker Award. It didn't win that, but it won the Shirley Jackson Award.
That's a big one.
So, yeah. So I spent about a dozen years just kind of writing short stories. It's just kind of a hobby and trying to, you know, make a few bucks off them here and there.
Well, I admire your persistence. I've heard a lot of stories of persistence and rejection from other writers. And to go through that nightmare with those publishers falling apart, that could be very discouraging. And I admire the fact that you've stuck with it, and here you are, and you've got a new book out on a major imprint. I think St. Martin's puts out more books under their imprints than any other publisher in America, even Random House and Penguin.
Yeah, you're probably right. I'm with Minotaur. I think their Suspense imprint.
Uh-huh. Yes, we cover a lot of books because I know Hector.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. And I think you
Hector connects me with a lot of your authors on this imprint.
Yeah, and I think you may have even did you write for Dayton Daily News?
I write a book review column for the Dayton Daily News, that's right.
Yeah, maybe a month ago you might have even given me a good plug in there.
I might have, yeah. Uh-huh. Hector yeah. told you, didn't he?
Thank you, sir. Yeah, uh-huh. I had that sense.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, that's me. That's
all right.
Okay. Well, you know, I like to do columns every few months or so that'll be kind of a rundown of stuff that's about ready to come out. And that way readers can be ready. You know, they can read like a little teaser about such and such a book and say, oh, I'm going to put that on my list to order that when that comes out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So you're constantly reading.
I like that. I bet you read a lot, don't you?
I do. Even with COVID, I wound up being a huge, just an even bigger bookworm.
Uh-huh. What kind of stuff do you like?
You know, I kind of this past year, I wound up finding, I just wanted to go with different authors. I was reading a lot of, John Sanford's kind of a local guy, a lot of most Michael Connelly's and Lee Child.
Mm-hmm.
Now that Lee has kind of handed it over to his brother, I've kind of backed off on that. But this this past year, I've really gotten into Peter Swanson.
Oh, I haven't read him.
He's good. They're kind of Hitchcockian mysteries, you know. And one of them is almost like a Strangers on a Plane, the kind to kill for.
Uh-huh.
And so they wound up being wonderful. And I think I gobbled up about 10 of his in like 2 or 3 months. And then Stephen Cavanaugh.
Isn't he great?
Oh, it's pure acid. It's legal uh-huh. thrillers on acid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's going to be big. He's got a new book coming that's just come out in the UK, and I don't know when it's coming out here, but he's going to be big.
Is it another of the?
I haven't read it, but I understand it's another legal thriller. Eddie Flynn, I think.
I am beyond amazed at these Irish gentlemen, because Kavanaugh and John Connolly, that, you know. Connolly's books are, you know, the East Coast, and he really gets into Maine. And I'm like, but you're in Ireland.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Same with Kavanaugh and New York. I always love the books where I'm enthusiastic to pick them up. And that's always kind of the gauge. Like, you know, the Kavanaughs, I'll be done 3 days later.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll have other books that are, you know, they're good, but I'll kind of put them down, then walk over and grab a donut to eat and walk and look out the window, and I'm not as the enthusiastic level as high.
Yeah. So you know, and you're a binge reader, it sounds like. You find somebody you like Kavanaugh or the Swanson, and
right.
you binge on them?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
I do.
Yeah, I'm binging on James Crumley right now myself. I've been tracking down all his books.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, I It's hilarious how, you know, you find someone and then boom, just got to gather everything that they've written.
Well, I've got to tell you, Jeffrey, I really enjoyed The Keepers, and I'm going to have to go dig up that first book in the series, and I'll be looking forward to reading the next one.
Well, thank you.
And that was Jeffrey Burton talking about his new novel, The Keepers, and we've got some extra time on the show this morning, so we're going to bring you a Book Nook bonus right after this. Thanks for tuning in this morning. The Book Nook continues with your special bonus segment recorded in 2002. Here's John LeSquaw talking about The Oath. Tell us how you got the idea for this one.
This is the first book that I ever took an idea from someone who came up to me and said, I've got an idea. Have I got an idea for you? it's probably happened to me, you know, 50 times since I've been writing, that somebody comes up and says, you know, this is a really good idea. You got to write about my mother-in-law who was really having a bad time with it. And I go, uh-huh, well, we'll get back to you. But this guy is a malpractice doctor in my area. And I was out fishing with him one day, and he said, have I got an idea, you know, really for you? And he said, this whole HMO medical malpractice doctors making a profit issue, he says, what you have to do is you have to look for the profit. In fact, I wrote the first half of the book under the title The Prophet. But then I figured, you know, everybody would mix me up with Khalil Gibran, you know, think I was one of these new age guys, and it wouldn't have worked as well. So I changed it to The Oath. Actually, my editor, Mitch Hoffman, came up with the title of The Oath, which I'm very happy with. And we just said, look, this is a great idea. This is a big issue that needs to be talked about. It kind of dropped off the public agenda when Hillary Clinton failed in her efforts to, you know, move it kind of front and center. And I think it still needs to be there because it remains a huge problem for many, many people.
Is there some kind of a problem with HMOs?
Yes, is the short answer.
Tell us about your own personal experience or that of your family members.
Well, number one, I've been around them quite a bit. My son was born with a hole in his heart, and he's fine, we had, you know, medical issues there. We're still with the same HMO provider that we had when he was born, just because we didn't want to change and you know, worry about getting new doctors and everything. But I've also had a little bit of bad luck in terms of being hit in ski injuries. I've been knocked down twice on the ski slopes in the last 4 years, and both times resulted in surgery. And also I've had cataracts in both of my eyes fixed since I last saw you. So I've been around doctors a lot. And not all of those experiences have been fantastic. All of them have worked, fortunately. But the one that really struck my mind in my own family was my wife as a ski patroller at Incline Village in Nevada. And she has been a ski patroller for several years. And she was skiing a couple of years ago and had an accident, fell down, and said, oh, God, I've blown my anterior cruciate ligament, which is a very common ski problem. It's what Jerry Rice had in football. So she walked into our HMO provider doctor, and she said, you know, doctor, I've blown my ACL out, and I need to get an MRI and have it, you know, operated on right away, because you don't want the muscle to atrophy. It atrophies very quickly if you don't fix it. Jerry Rice's case, they gave him the operation the same night that he had the injury. That's how quick they want to work on it. Her doctor looked at her knee and said, you know, you didn't blow your ACL out. Your knee's too tight. He said, it'd be much looser if you'd blown your ACL out. And she said, well, I know I blew my ACL out. I mean, I've seen this 100 times. And she goes, why don't we just have an MRI and settle it, you know, and then we can go in and get it operated on. He goes, I'm only allowed to give 5 MRIs a month, and I don't think you have blown out your ACL. So we had to go through getting a doctor's appointment with another guy that we paid out of our pocket for, $140, out of our, you know, not insured. He immediately, as my wife was walking across the office, said, oh, blew out your ACL, did you? He wrote her out the diagnosis, and based on that diagnosis, she brought it back to my doctor, who then could get the MRI, who then they had the operation 4 months later. So the recovery, instead of being a very, you know, still difficult 2 or 3 months, was a difficult two years. And that's not uncommon. That's a very normal scenario in doctors who are being told to not give care or to withhold care or find the cheapest way to do it or to do physical therapy to repair rotator cuffs. You know, physical therapy doesn't repair rotator cuffs. And I bet you got some friends right now who are crawling their fingers up a wall trying to stretch their arm to make their rotator cuff better.
Most of them are major league pitchers, but you're right.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, it's a huge problem, and those are kind of the simple mechanical problems, ACLs and rotator cuffs and that kind of thing. The cancer diagnoses and the lack of testing, those are more serious and probably more prevalent.
And it starts off with a guy going for a jog.
Right. He does a jog every morning. It's a very San Francisco thing to do.
Especially if you live in that really nice place where he lives.
It is a really nice area. In fact, I just drove through it the other day again. I was up in the city and said, I'm going to make sure I got all the streets right, you know. And I did, and it was really fun. And I said, that's where he got it, right there. a car just came by and whacked him. Hit and run. Must have been an accident.
And that sets the stage. Now, this guy who's hit, do you want to say what his job was?
He's the CEO of Parnassus Health, which is a health maintenance organization in San Francisco that is really severely embattled right now. It's making no money. It's having bunches of problems with their drug formulary and their doctors because they're not making money. It's the same old money versus care argument that really is endemic.
So we have a situation not uncommon for an HMO where there's a lot of pressure to make sure that they keep costs down and that they stay solvent.
Right.
And this guy gets hit by the car, and this releases a whole bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
Now, with this kind of book, I'm always leery to really say very much about what happens. Do you want to kind of give an overview?
Well, I think what happens is it, obviously, someone, this being the kind of book that I like to write, you like to have somebody who's now in trouble because of this. And he, when this man, Tim Markham, is admitted to the hospital, he, of course, goes to the operating room, and then he's taken up to the ICU. And the man in charge of the ICU is a doctor named Eric Kensing. Kensing becomes the suspect in what turns out to be a murder case because Kensing doesn't live. I mean, Markham does not live. He turns out to have been overdosed with potassium while he was in the hospital. And the person who killed him knew that the hospital typically, people who die in the ICU typically are not given an autopsy, he thought. But what throws a wrench into this picture is that it's a hit and run, which makes it a homicide. And suddenly, all homicides, no matter what, they do autopsies with in San Francisco.
And you love to get the reader going in different directions and confusing the reader.
Yes, I do.
At the very beginning of the book, we don't even think that this guy's going to make it to the right hospital. We think he's going to be DOA going to the county hospital because he doesn't have any identification.
He doesn't have any ID. Well, you know, it's one of the real lessons of our society is, you know, when you go out jogging, carry your ID. You know, I mean, imagine if Stephen King hadn't had his ID when he was hit a few years ago. He, you know, who knows?
He'd probably still be
in a coma somewhere.
It's very
possible. Because he wouldn't have had a good doctor. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know what happened there, but it's important to have an ID when you run.
Well, there was something in the paper the other day, I don't know if you saw this, where there was some controversy about these doctors offering, if you were willing to pay even more money above and beyond your HMO stuff to actually get decent service.
I tell you, that's what this book is about. It's about what about if you're stuck? If you're, you know, if, for example, in the case of Parnassus, this has the contract for all the city workers of San Francisco. You're talking 65,000 people, you know, who are not making huge amounts of money. They're living. They got their living wage. And part of the reason they can live in San Francisco is because they've got insurance for their medical problems. And if they have a problem, it costs them $5. But it doesn't help them if they pay $5 and really get no service. And that's really the situation that I think a lot of HMO patients find themselves in. It's not that all HMOs are bad, but most HMOs, if not all, are under a severe financial crunch. And all of them are cutting as much as they can cut. We just read in the New York Times yesterday that there's a huge thing with drugs for, I love this, elderly cancer patients. That suddenly, I think, Kaiser, Health Net, all the big ones decided they're just not going to cover anymore. Can't afford it. Oh, you have cancer? You're old? Oh, sorry, you're dead.
We're doing the mime radio.
We're doing
now.
The mime. We're having a mime moment on radio.
My guest is John Lesquois. The book is The Oath. As I mentioned earlier, John, you like to throw the reader off.
Mm-hmm.
You really enjoy that, don't you?
I like to. I think part of the pleasure of reading is being fooled. I think there's a lot of fun when you think you're going somewhere. This book, I'll tell you, this book, the San Francisco Chronicle came out with it and said it has just an unbelievable whip snap of an ending, which I was very happy to see because it does. Everybody's waiting for, you know, the courtroom scene that I typically end my book with, or at least have near the end. And this book doesn't go where you think it's going to go. And I have a great enjoyment out of writing it. Yeah.
Yeah, they call it a legal thriller, and I was waiting for that courtroom thing, too.
Yeah, there's a couple of grand jury scenes, you know, and there's a lawyer, Hardy, is trying to get his client off all the way through. But, you know, it just didn't want to go that way. There was much more action in the book than I probably planned at the beginning. But as I kept writing it, things kept happening, and I wanted to just follow those things. I had my two rookie cops who didn't know what they were doing, which was really kind of fun. And, you know, I like, because I deal with serious themes, I like to have a lot of fun in these books, a lot of humor. And, you know, I think some of the dialogue makes people laugh. It's kind of fun stuff.
And you had this hard-boiled 30-year veteran cop who's a key character.
Abe Glitzky.
Yeah.
He's my man. He's the, you know, he's in all the books. He was the kind of the star of Guilt, actually. Hardy didn't even appear in Guilt. And when these books start, I never know which one is going to take over. And the last two books in a row, Glitzky's kind of taken over as the, at least the emotional center of both of them. He's just a terrific guy. He's a very, very driven, very moral, very concerned guy. Really not a fun guy. Really. Uh-huh. I wouldn't say this is Mr. Fun. And for some reason, my guy Hardy, who is pretty fun, loves him. I mean, would do anything for him. And In this book, they get in their first fight, really. Well, probably their second fight, but a very serious fight that threatens their relationship.
Now, I get the impression that maybe Hardy's getting the baton at the end of this one. Maybe he's going to be the key character in the next book.
Well, I'm 120 pages into it, and he seems to have a role. And all I'll say about this is that all the characters, about the next book, is that all the characters that are alive at the end of this book will be in the next book.
Okay, I'll accept that. That was your Book Nook bonus, John Lesquois, recorded back in 2002, talking about his novel, The Oath. And we still have a little extra time left on the show this morning, and you're in luck. Don't touch that dial. We've got a special Book Nook double bonus right now for you. Sometimes I'll discover a writer who is no longer with us, and I'll say to myself, I wish I could have interviewed that writer. And one such writer is Charles Williford. I'm going to read you a super short story by Charles Williford that'll give you some idea of just why I would have loved to have talked to him. This is called Give the Man a Cigar by Charles Williford. Señor Armando Martinez came into my shop a little before noon, and I uncrossed my fingers. He usually came by for a cigar every weekday, but sometimes he missed a day. I had been waiting for him, and I was very glad to see him. Martinez was the big shot editor of El Grito, perhaps the most strident of the 10 weekly Spanish newspapers published in Miami. He was wearing a brown silk suit with tiny gold threads in it, a white silk shirt, and a lemon yellow Countess Mara necktie. He pointed to the box of Queen Isabella's in the glass case. I smiled, shook my head, and unlocked the drawer beneath the cash register. I took out the box of Ramon Navarone's, placed it on the counter, and raised the lid. Jesus, he said, with a little laugh. Navarone's? I haven't seen one of them for at least 3 years. Where'd you get them? A friend of mine in the Isle of Pines. He ships a few boxes every year to a friend of mine in Toronto. Then, when my friend from Toronto comes down for the season, he sometimes brings me one or two boxes to sell. This year he only brought one box. Martinez fingered a couple of the Navarones in the box with a gentle touch. The cigars were 10 inches long, hand-milled, maduros, oily, and as black as Castro's heart. Martinez selected a cigar. I put the box away, locked the drawer, and then lit a kitchen match. Martinez held the tip of the cigar an inch above the flame and turned the cigar slowly as he lighted it. Jesus, he said, this is good. I could eat the damn thing. He held the cigar between his teeth, took out his wallet, and placed three $1 bills on the counter. I shook my head. Two more. $5? I shrugged. It's a Navarone. He added two more ones to the three bills on the counter. I lighted a Winston 100 with my Bic disposable lighter. Don't you smoke Navarones? I can't afford them, I said. Martinez still had his wallet out. He removed a five. Give me another. No. I shook my head. The others are spoken for. It's not for me, Martinez argued. It's for my father-in-law. The others are spoken for. Martinez put his wallet away. As he pulled his coat back, I noticed the handle of the .38 pistol and the shell clip and holster on his belt. He buttoned the middle button of his jacket. I lowered my voice.
Perez is looking for you, Señor Martinez.
Perez? I nodded.
He didn't like what you said about the bombing in your editorial.
I told the truth. I shrugged. Truth or no truth, don't go to the Cafe Toledo for lunch today.
Is that where he is?
I nodded. Raul and Annabel are with him. Martinez went to the window and looked across the street at the Cafe Toledo. He had his own special table at the Toledo and ate lunch there every day. His white Mercedes was parked in front of my shop. I knew that he was afraid to leave the shop and get into his car.
Señor Martinez, I said, why don't you go out the back? Leave me your keys, and when my son comes home from school, I have him drive your car to your father-in-law's house.
He turned.
What's out back?
The alley.
50 yards down the alley is the back of the Granada supermarket. You can go through the market and catch a cab on 7th Street.
I do not fear Perez, he said, throwing out his chest. Sweat beads glistened in his mustache.
Perez alone, no, I said, but he has Raul and Annabel with him.
That is true. I also have many friends and supporters in Miami.
At least as many as Perez. More, because I tell the truth in my paper.
If you want to tell the truth in your paper tomorrow, I said, you should go out the back today.
Martinez hesitated for a moment and then took out his key case. He removed the key to his Mercedes and placed it on the counter.
Does your son know my father-in-law's house?
I will tell him.
I unlocked the back door to let Martinez out. I pointed down the alley to a huge pile of empty cardboard boxes.
The back door to the market is on the other side of those boxes, I said. There are always one or two cabs waiting out front.
He slipped out the door, and I locked it behind him. I picked up the phone on the wall and dialed. I let the phone ring twice. Then I hung up. I waited for 5 minutes, and then I unlocked the back door. I stuck my head out and listened. I did not hear the shots, but I could hear the sirens of the police cars as they pulled up in front of the Granada supermarket on 7th Street. I closed and locked the back door. I took the box of Ramon Navarones from the drawer, opened it, and selected one. As I rolled the cigar between my fingers, I could feel the fine film of oil. There was no crackle, and the cigar was firm. I lighted the Navarone with a kitchen match. Now I could afford to smoke Ramon Navarones. Every cigar in the box. Charles Williford, he could write a story. He could write a novel. That was called Give the Man a Cigar. And that's from the second Black Lizard anthology of crime fiction, which came out in 1988. And you heard it on the Book Nook. Tune in tomorrow morning at 10:30 when Julie Klamm will return to the program. Her new book is called The Almost Legendary Morris Sisters, a true story of family fiction. You might recall Julie Klamm wrote what I consider to be the best book about dogs ever written. It's called You Had Me at Woof. Julie Klamm returning to the show tomorrow morning at 10:30 right here on WYSO. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for tuning in.